For long ago, when the sons of Tyndarus invaded the land of Attica with an army in pursuit of Helen's recovery, and were driving the people from their homes, not knowing where Helen had been hidden away, then, they say, the Decelians, or as some say, Decelus himself, aggrieved at Theseus' outrage and fearing for the whole territory of the Athenians, explained the whole matter to them and guided them to Aphidnae, which Tydacus, a native of the place, betrayed to the sons of Tyndarus. For this deed the Decelians have had, from that deed, exemption from taxes and front seats at Sparta, continuing even to this day. So much so that even in the war that arose many years later between the Athenians and the Peloponnesians, while the Lacedaemonians were ravaging the rest of Attica, they kept away from Decelia. Being of this deem, and having distinguished himself then above all the Athenians, Sophanes has two stories told of him. One, that from the belt of his breastplate he carried an iron anchor fastened by a bronze chain, which he would hurl down whenever he drew near the enemy, so that the enemy, breaking out of their ranks, could not dislodge him from his position. And when the enemy took to flight, it was arranged that he would take up the anchor and so pursue them. This is one account. The other story, disputing the one told first, says that he carried an anchor, always circling about and never still, on his shield, and not one of iron fastened to his breastplate. There is also another brilliant deed accomplished by Sophanes. While the Athenians were besieging Aegina, he killed Eurybates the Argive, a champion of the pentathlon, in single combat by challenge. Sophanes himself, sometime after these events, met his end as a valiant man, serving as general of the Athenians together with Legris, son of Glaucon, killed by the Edonians at Datis while fighting over the gold mines. Now when the barbarians had been struck down and laid low by the Greeks at Plataea, there came to them a woman deserting from the enemy. She, when she learned that the Persians had perished and that the Greeks were victorious, being the concubine of Pherandates, son of Thespes, a Persian, adorned herself and her attendants with much gold and in the finest clothing she had, and stepping down from her covered wagon went toward the Lacedaemonians, who were still in the midst of the slaughter. And seeing Pausanias directing all of it, having known his name and his country beforehand, from having heard of them often, she recognized Pausanias, and taking hold of his knees, said the following: "O king of Sparta, save me, your suppliant, from the slavery of captivity. For you have already done good service in this, having destroyed these men who have regard neither for spirits nor for gods. I am by birth a woman of Cos, daughter of Hegetoride, son of Antigoras. The Persian took me by force while I was in Cos and held me there." He answered her thus: "Woman, take heart, both as a suppliant, and if besides you happen to be speaking the truth and are indeed the daughter of Hegetorides of Cos, who happens to be my greatest friend among those who dwell in those parts." Having said this, he at that time entrusted her to the ephors who were present, and later sent her to Aegina, to which she herself wished to go. After the arrival of this woman, immediately after, the Mantineans arrived when everything was already done. And learning that they had arrived after the fighting was already over, they took it as a great misfortune, and said they deserved to be punished for it. Learning that the Medes who were fleeing with Artabazus were still fleeing, they pursued them as far as Thessaly, but the Lacedaemonians would not allow them to pursue the fugitives. Returning to their own land, they drove the commanders of their army into exile. After the Mantineans came the Eleans, and the Eleans likewise, taking it as a great misfortune like the Mantineans, went away, and they too, on their return, drove their commanders into exile. So much for the affair of the Mantineans and Eleans. In the camp at Plataea, among the Aeginetans, there was Lampon, son of Pythias, one of the foremost men of Aegina. He, having in mind a most unholy proposal, hastened to Pausanias, and coming to him said the following in urgency: "Son of Cleombrotus, a deed has been accomplished by you of extraordinary greatness and beauty, and God has granted to you, having saved Greece, to lay up the greatest glory of all the Greeks we know of. Do you now also carry out what remains to be done after this, so that even greater fame may attach to you, and so that in future any of the barbarians may be on guard against committing reckless deeds against the Greeks. For when Leonidas died at Thermopylae, Mardonius and Xerxes cut off his head and impaled it. If you repay them in like manner, you will win praise first from all the Spartans, and again from the rest of the Greeks as well. for by impaling Mardonius you will avenge your uncle Leonidas. He said this thinking to please Pausanias, but Pausanias answered him as follows. Aeginetan stranger, I admire your good will and your foresight, but you have missed the mark of sound judgment. You raised me up high, along with my country and my deed, and then cast me down to nothing by urging me to mistreat a corpse. That is a thing better suited to barbarians than to Greeks, and even in them we resent it. As for me, on this account, I would not wish to please the Aeginetans or anyone else who takes pleasure in such things. It is enough for me to please the Spartans by doing and saying what is right. As for Leonidas, whom you bid me avenge, I say he has been greatly avenged already. By the countless lives of these men here he has been honored, he himself and the others who died at Thermopylae. But you, so long as you hold such talk, do not come to me, nor give me such counsel, and be grateful that you go unpunished. Having heard this, the man went away. Pausanias then made a proclamation that no one should touch the plunder, and ordered the helots to gather the goods together. And they, scattering through the camp, found tents furnished with gold and silver, couches overlaid with gold and silver, golden mixing bowls, bowls, and other drinking vessels of every kind. They found sacks on wagons in which were seen cauldrons of gold and silver. And from the corpses lying there they stripped bracelets and torques and daggers of gold. Though of embroidered clothing, no one took any account. There the helots stole much and sold it to the Aeginetans, and much too they revealed openly, whatever they could not hide. So that from this, the great wealth of the Aeginetans first began, for they bought the gold from the helots as though it were bronze. When the goods had been gathered together and a tenth set apart for the god at Delphi, from which the golden tripod was dedicated, the one standing on the bronze three-headed serpent nearest the altar, and a tenth was set apart for the god at Olympia, from which they dedicated a bronze Zeus 10 cubits high, and for the god at the Isthmus, from which came a bronze Poseidon 7 cubits high. When they had set these apart, they divided the rest among themselves, and each man took what he deserved. And also the concubines of the Persians and the gold and silver and other goods and the pack animals. Now what was set aside as a special prize and given to those who had distinguished themselves at Plataea is not told by anyone, though I myself suppose that gifts were given to these men too. To Pausanias, however, everything was given tenfold and chosen out for him, women, horses, talents, camels, and likewise the rest of the goods as well. It is also said that this happened, that when Xerxes fled from Greece, he left his own equipment behind for Mardonius. So Pausanias, seeing Mardonius's furnishings set out with gold and silver and embroidered hangings, told the bakers and the cooks to make a dinner just as they would have for Mardonius. When these men, so ordered, did this, then Pausanias, seeing golden and silver couches well spread, and golden and silver tables and the magnificent preparation of the meal, was amazed by the fine spread laid out before him, and, as a joke, told his own servants to make a Laconian dinner instead. When this meal was made ready, the difference between the two was great, and Pausanias, laughing, sent for the generals of the Greeks. And when they had gathered, Pausanias said, pointing to each of the two preparations of the meal, "Men of Greece, for this reason I brought you together, wishing to show you the folly of this leader of the Medes, who, living in such luxury as this, still came against us who have so wretched a way of life, to take it from us." This is what Pausanias is said to have said to the generals of the Greeks. And afterward, in later time, many of the Plataeans found buried stores of gold and silver and other goods. And this too became apparent afterward, once the flesh had been stripped from the bones of the dead. For the Plataeans were gathering the bones into one place, and a skull was found having no suture at all but being made of a single bone, and a jawbone also appeared having, in the upper jaw, teeth all grown from a single bone, both the front teeth and the molars, and the bones of a man 5 cubits tall were found. When, on the second day, the body of Mardonius had disappeared, I cannot say with certainty by whose hand, though I have heard that many and various people buried Mardonius, and I know that many received great gifts from Artaunts, son of Mardonius, for this deed. But who it was that took up and buried the body of Mardonius, I am not able to learn with certainty. There is also a report that Dionysophanes, a man of Ephesus, buried Mardonius. In such fashion, then, he was buried, whichever way it was. As for the Greeks, once they had divided the plunder at Plataea, each people buried their own dead separately. The Lacedaemonians made three graves. In one they buried the young men, among whom were Posidonius and Amampharetus, and Philocaon and Callicrates. In one of the graves, then, were the young men, in the other the rest of the Spartiates, and in the third the Helots. Thus did they bury their dead. The Tegeans buried all their dead together apart from the others, while the Athenians buried theirs as one group, and the Megarians and Phlyasians those slain by the enemy cavalry. Of all these, then, the graves were full of bodies. But as for the others, whatever graves are to be seen at Plataea belonging to other peoples, these, as I learn, were heaped up empty as mounds of earth by each people out of shame at their absence from the battle, for the sake of those who came after. For there is even at that place a so-called grave of the Aeginetans, which, I hear, was heaped up 10 years after these events, at the request of the Aeginetans, by Cleides son of Autodicus, a Plataean man who was their proxenos. When the Greeks had thus buried the dead at Plataea, straightway it was resolved in council that they should march against Thebes and demand the surrender of those who had sided with the Medes, first among them Timagenetas and Atagenus, who were the foremost leaders of that faction. And if the Thebans refused to surrender them, they resolved not to withdraw from the city before capturing it. When they had decided this, on the 11th day after the battle they arrived and laid siege to the Thebans, demanding that they hand over the men. And when the Thebans would not consent to surrender them, they ravaged their land and made assaults upon the wall. And since the Greeks did not cease from doing damage, on the 20th day Timagenetas said the following to the Thebans: "Men of Thebes, since the Greeks have resolved on this, not to give up the siege until they take Thebes or you hand us over to them, now let not the land of Boeotia suffer further on our account. But if it is money they want, and they demand us merely as a pretext, let us give them money from the public treasury, for it was with the whole city's consent that we sided with the Medes, not we alone. But if they are besieging you because they truly want us, we ourselves will present ourselves to them for judgment." This seemed to be very well and fittingly said, and at once the Thebans sent heralds to Pausanias, willing to hand over the men. When they had come to terms on these conditions, Atagenus fled from the city. But his sons, though led away, Pausanias released from the charge, saying that children could have no part in the guilt of medizing. As for the other men whom the Thebans handed over, they supposed they would get a hearing, and indeed trusted that they could buy themselves off with money. But Pausanias, when he received them, suspecting exactly this, dismissed the whole army of the allies, and taking the men to Corinth, put them to death. This, then, is what happened at Plataea and Thebes. Artabazus, son of Pharnaces, fleeing from Plataea, was already getting far away. When he arrived among the Thessalians, they invited him to their hospitality and asked him about the rest of the army, knowing nothing of what had happened at Plataea. Artabazus, realizing that if he wished to tell them the whole truth of the battle, he himself and the army with him would be in danger of destruction, for he thought that everyone would set upon them once they learned what had happened. Reckoning this, he revealed nothing to the Phocians and said the following to the Thessalians: "I myself, men of Thessaly, as you see, am hastening at speed to make my way into Thrace, and am in haste, having been sent on some business from the camp along with these men. Mardonius himself and his army are close behind me and are expected to arrive. Entertain him and show yourselves doing well by him, for you will not regret it in time to come." Having said this, he drove his army in haste through Thessaly and Macedonia straight toward Thrace, as one truly in a hurry, cutting across the inland route. And he arrived at Byzantium, having left behind many of his own army, cut down along the way by the Thracians, or perishing of hunger and exhaustion, and from Byzantium he crossed over by ships. Thus did he make his way back to Asia. On the very same day that the defeat at Plataea took place, it happened also that one occurred at Mycale in Ionia. For when the Greeks who had come in their ships with Leutychides the Lacedaemonian were lying at Delos, messengers came to them from Samos, Lampon son of Thrasicles, and Athenagoras son of Archestratides, and Hegesistratus son of Aristagoras, sent by the Samians secretly from the Persians and from Theomester the tyrant, son of Andradamas, the man the Persians had installed as tyrant of Samos. When they came before the generals, Hegesistratus said many things of every sort, how, if only the Ionians should see them, they would revolt from the Persians, and how the barbarians would not stand their ground. And even if they should stand their ground, they would not find such another prey as this. He called on the gods too, he called on them in common and urged them to free the Greeks from slavery and to drive back the barbarian. He said this would be easy for them, since the Persians' ships sailed badly and were no match for theirs. And they themselves, he said, if the Greeks suspected that the Samians were leading them into a trap, were ready to be taken aboard the Greek ships as hostages. As he went on pleading at length, Leutychides asked the Samian stranger whether he wished to learn an omen from it or whether it happened by pure chance with a god at work. Samian stranger, what is your name? And he said, Hegesistratus. Leutychides cut off the rest of whatever Hegesistratus was about to say and said, I accept the omen of Hegesistratus, Samian stranger. Now see to it that you give us your pledge and sail off, you and these men with you, and that the Samians will indeed be eager allies for us. As he said this, he also pushed the matter forward with action. At once the Samians made pledge and oaths concerning alliance with the Greeks. Having done this, some of them sailed off, for Leutychides bade Hegesistratus sail with them, taking his name as an omen. The Greeks, having held back that day, on the next performed sacrifices for good omens, with Daphonus, son of Euenius, a man of Apollonia, the Apollonia on the Ionian Gulf, divining for them. His father Euenius had met with the following experience. In this Apollonia, there are sheep sacred to the sun, which by day graze along the river Chon, which flows from Mount Lacmon through the territory of Apollonia down to the coast near the harbor of Oricum. And at night, men selected from the citizens most notable for wealth and family origin stand guard over them, 1 year apiece. For the Apollonians hold these sheep in great account because of some oracle. They are penned at night in a cave far from the city. It was there that this Euenius, having been chosen, was keeping guard. And once, when he had fallen asleep at his post, wolves came past the guard into the cave and destroyed about 60 of the sheep. When he became aware of it, he kept silent and told no one, meaning to replace them by buying others in their place. But this did not escape the Apollonians. When they learned of it, they brought him before a court and condemned him for having let his watch fall asleep to be deprived of his sight. When they had blinded Euenius, immediately after this, their sheep ceased to bear young, and the land no longer yielded crops as before. Oracles came to them from both Dodona and Delphi. When they questioned the prophets about what lay behind their misfortune, the prophets explained that they had unjustly deprived Euenius, the guardian of the sacred sheep, of his sight. For the gods themselves had sent the wolves against them, and would not cease avenging him until they paid him whatever compensation he himself should choose and judge fitting. And when this had been done, the gods themselves would give Euenius such a gift that many men would count him blessed for having it. This was the oracle given to them, and the Apollonians, keeping it secret, assigned certain of the citizens to carry it out. And they carried it out in this way. As Euenius sat on his bench, they came and sat beside him and talked of other things, until they came around to condoling with him over his misfortune. Leading him on in this way, they asked him what compensation he would choose if the Apollonians were willing to submit to paying for what they had done. He, not having heard the oracle, made his choice, saying that if someone gave him the fields, naming among the citizens' land the two finest allotments he knew of in Apollonia, and besides these the house which he knew to be the finest in the city, then, having obtained these, he would bear no further grudge, and this compensation, once given, would satisfy him. And as he was saying this, the men sitting beside him broke in and said, Euenius, the Apollonians pay you this compensation for your blinding in accordance with an oracle that has been given. At this, he was greatly troubled, once he learned from that the whole story, feeling he had been deceived. But they bought the properties from those who held them and gave him what he had chosen. And after this, he at once possessed an inborn gift of prophecy, so that he even became famous for it. It was this man's son Daphonus who, brought along by the Corinthians, was doing the divining for the army. I have also heard this, that Daphonus, assuming the name of Euenius, undertook work on behalf of Greece, though he was not actually the son of Euenius. When the sacrifices proved favorable for the Greeks, they put out from Delos toward Samos. When they came to the part of Samos near Calamai, some of them anchored there off the Herion in that place and prepared for a sea battle, while the Persians, learning that the Greeks were sailing toward them, likewise put out to sea toward the mainland with the rest of the ships, but the Phoenician ships they sent off to sail away. For on deliberation, it seemed best to them not to fight a sea battle, since they did not think themselves a match. They sailed off toward the mainland, so as to be under cover of their own land army stationed at Mycale, which by order of Xerxes had been left behind from the rest of the army to guard Ionia. It numbered 60,000, and its commander was Tigranes, who surpassed the Persians in beauty and stature. Under the protection of this army, the generals of the fleet resolved to take refuge, to haul their ships ashore, and to build around them a fence and defense for the ships and a place of refuge for themselves. Having resolved this, they put out to sea. When they came, past the shrine of the Potniae on Mycale, to Geison and Scolopoes, where there is a shrine of Eleusinian Demeter, which Philistus son of Pasicles had founded when he accompanied Neleus son of Codrus to the founding of Miletus. There they hauled up the ships and built around them a fence of both stones and timber, cutting down cultivated trees, and drove stakes around the fence, and made ready both for a siege and for victory, preparing with both outcomes in mind. The Greeks, when they learned that the barbarians had gone off to the mainland, were troubled, thinking that they had escaped them, and were at a loss what to do, whether to turn back or to sail toward the Hellespont. In the end, they decided to do neither, but to sail against the mainland. So, having made ready for a sea battle both landing ladders and everything else they needed, they sailed for Mycale. When they came near the camp and no one appeared coming out against them, but they saw ships drawn up inside the wall and a great infantry force arrayed along the shore, then first, sailing along in his ship and bringing it as close to the shore as possible, Leutychides had a herald proclaim to the Ionians, saying, "Men of Ionia, whoever of you happens to be listening, mark what I say. The Persians will understand none of what I am telling you. When we join battle, each of you must remember freedom first of all, and after that the watchword Hebe. And let whoever among you does not hear this learn it from whoever did." This device had the very same intent as that of Themistocles at Artemisium. Either the words, escaping the barbarians' notice, would persuade the Ionians, or, if reported back to the barbarians, would make them distrust the Greeks. After Leutychides had suggested this, the Greeks next did as follows. They brought their ships to shore and disembarked onto the beach. And these were forming up in ranks, while the Persians, when they saw the Greeks preparing for battle and urging the Ionians on, first, suspecting the Samians of favoring the Greek cause, stripped them of their weapons. For the Samians, when Athenian captives arrived among the barbarian ships, those whom Xerxes' men had captured, left behind throughout Attica. These the Samians had ransomed, all of them, and sent them off to Athens provided with supplies. And because of this, they were held under no small suspicion, having ransomed 500 lives of Xerxes' enemies. Second, they put the Milesians in charge of guarding the paths up to Mycale's summits, using as pretext that no one knew the terrain better than they did. They did this for this reason, so that the Milesians would be kept away from the camp. In these ways, the Persians took precautions beforehand against those of the Ionians whom they suspected might, given the opportunity, do something disruptive, and they themselves gathered their wicker shields together to serve as a barricade. When the Greeks had made their preparations, they advanced against the barbarians, and as they went, a rumor flew into the whole camp, and a herald's staff was seen lying on the shoreline. And the rumor spread among them in this way, that the Greeks were victorious over Mardonius' army, fighting in Boeotia. Many proofs make clear that divine matters govern human affairs, since even then, when the same day coincided with the disaster about to befall both at Plataea and at Mycale, a rumor reached the Greeks in that place, so that the army took much greater courage and was more eager to face danger with spirit. And this other thing also happened to coincide. There were precincts of Eleusinian Demeter near both battle sites. For indeed at Plataea the battle took place right beside the very temple of Demeter, as I have said before, and at Mycale it was likewise about to happen. And the rumor that came to them, that the Greeks under Pausanias had won a victory, turned out to be accurate. For the battle at Plataea took place still early in the day, while that at Mycale took place around late afternoon. That they happened on the same day and the same month became clear to them not long afterward, when they worked it out. Before the rumor reached them, they had been afraid, not so much for themselves as for the Greeks, lest Greece should stumble because of Mardonius. But when this report flew in to them, they pressed their advance all the more, and more swiftly. So the Greeks and the barbarians alike hastened to battle, since the islands and the Hellespont lay before them as prizes. For the Athenians and those stationed next to them, up to about half the line, the march went along the shore and the level ground, while the Lacedaemonians and those posted next to them were arrayed along a ravine and among the hills. While the Lacedaemonians were making their way around, the troops on the other wing were already fighting. As long as the wicker shields of the Persians stood upright, they defended themselves and held their own in the battle no less than their opponents. But when the army of the Athenians and those next to them, so that the achievement might be theirs and not the Lacedaemonians, urged each other on and pressed the work more eagerly, from that point, the affair took a different turn. For once they had pushed down the wicker shields, they charged in a mass upon the Persians, who received them and resisted for a long time, but at last fled to the wall. The Athenians, Corinthians, Sicyonians, and Troezenians, for it was in this order that they had been posted, followed close behind and burst into the wall along with them. And once the wall too had been taken, the barbarians no longer turned to defend themselves but set out in flight, all except the Persians. These, forming into small groups, kept fighting against whichever of the Greeks kept bursting into the wall. Of the Persian commanders, two escaped, and two died. Artaints and Ithamiters, who commanded the fleet, got away, whereas Mardonts and Tigranes, who led the infantry, fell in the fighting. While the Persians were still fighting, the Lacedaemonians and those with them arrived, and finished off the rest along with them. Many of the Greeks themselves also fell there, among others the Sicyonians and their general Paralaus. And of the Samians who were serving in the Median camp and had been stripped of their weapons, as soon as they saw that the battle was, right from the start, turning out to favor now one side, now the other, they did whatever they could, wishing to help the Greeks. When the other Ionians saw the Samians take the lead in this way, they too revolted from the Persians and turned on the barbarians. The Milesians had been assigned by the Persians to guard the mountain passes for their own safety, so that if disaster should befall them, as indeed it did, they might have guides to bring them safely to the summits of Mycale. The Milesians were posted to this task both for that reason and so that they would not be present in the camp to cause any disturbance. But they did the very opposite of what had been ordered, leading the fleeing Persians by other paths, which in fact brought them to the enemy, and in the end they themselves became the deadliest enemies, killing them. Thus Ionia broke away from Persian rule for a second time. In this battle, the Athenians distinguished themselves among the Greeks, and among the Athenians Hermolycus, son of Euthynous, a man trained in the Pancratium. This Hermolycus later met his end. Once fighting broke out between Athens and Carystus, falling in battle at Caenus in Carystian land, where he lies buried at Geristus. After the Athenians, the Corinthians, Troezenians, and Sicyonians distinguished themselves. When the Greeks had dealt with most of the barbarians, some killing them in battle and some as they fled, they burned the ships and the whole wall, having first brought out the plunder onto the shore, and they found some treasuries of goods as well. And having burned the wall and the ships, they sailed away. On arriving at Samos, the Greeks discussed resettling Ionia, weighing which region of Greece under their own control would be suitable for the Ionians to inhabit, while abandoning Ionia itself to the barbarians. It seemed to them impossible to keep permanent watch over the Ionians by stationing forces there indefinitely. Yet without such a guard, they held no hope that the Ionians could escape unpunished from Persian retaliation. Given this, the Peloponnesian leaders who held command decided it was best to drive out the trading populations among the Greek peoples who had sided with Persia and hand their territory over for the Ionians to settle. The Athenians, however, objected entirely to uprooting Ionia and likewise objected to Peloponnesian involvement in decisions about their own colonies. Since the Athenians resisted forcefully, the Peloponnesians backed down. In this way, they took in the Samians, Chians, Lesbians, and the rest of the islanders, who happened to be campaigning alongside the Greeks, and enrolled them in the alliance, binding them by pledge and oath to stay loyal and never break away. Once these oaths were secured, the fleet sailed off to dismantle the bridges, still expecting to find them intact. This group then made for the Hellespont. Meanwhile, the barbarians who had fled and been herded onto the heights of Mycale, not being numerous, managed to reach Sardis. As they went along the road, Masiste, son of Darius, came upon the disaster that had just occurred and heaped abuse on the commander Artens, calling him, among other insults, more cowardly than a woman for leading the campaign as he had, and declaring he deserved every punishment for the ruin he had brought on the king's house. Among Persians, being called worse than a woman ranks as the harshest possible insult. Artens, once he had heard enough of this, flew into a rage and drew his scimitar against Masiste, meaning to kill him. But Xenagoras, son of Praxileos, a man of Halicarnassus, standing behind him, saw him rushing at Masiste, seized him around the middle, lifted him up, and threw him to the ground. And in that moment, Masiste's spearmen stepped forward to protect him. Xenagoras did this deed as a favor to Masiste himself and to Xerxes in saving the latter's brother. And because of this deed, Xenagoras was given rule over the whole of Cilicia by the king's gift. Of those traveling along the road, nothing further happened beyond this, and they arrived at Sardis. Now at Sardis, the king had been staying ever since he had fled there after his setback in the sea battle off Athens. At that time, while staying at Sardis, he fell in love with the wife of Masiste, who was also there at the time. When his approaches to her could not bring about his desire, and he did not resort to force, out of consideration for his brother Masiste, the same held true for the woman as well, for she knew well that she would not be subjected to force. At this point, Xerxes, refraining from other means, arranged this marriage. He gave his own son Darius the daughter of this woman and Masiste, thinking he would win her the more readily if he did this. Having concluded the match and performed the customary rites, he drove off to Susa, and when he arrived there and brought the woman home for Darius, he then ceased his desire for the wife of Masiste, and having shifted his affection, he came to love and to have as his own the wife of Darius, the daughter of Masiste, and this woman's name was Artent. As time went on, the affair came to light in the following way. Amestris, Xerxes' wife, having woven a great, richly decorated robe worthy to behold, gave it to Xerxes. He, delighted, put it on and went to Artent, and being pleased with her as well, he told her to ask for whatever she wished to have in return for her favors to him, for she would obtain anything she asked. But since it was fated that ruin should come upon her whole household, in response to this she said to Xerxes, "Will you give me whatever I ask of you?" He, supposing she would ask for anything but that, promised and swore it. And she, once he had sworn, boldly asked for the robe. Xerxes tried everything, unwilling to give it, for no other reason than his fear of Amestris, lest she, who already suspected what was happening, should thereby discover it for certain. Instead, he offered cities and boundless gold and an army, of which no one but she should have command. An army is indeed a very Persian gift. But since he could not persuade her, he gave the robe. She, overjoyed with the gift, wore it and gloried in it. And Amestris learned that she had it, and having learned what was going on, she bore no anger toward this woman. But supposing that her mother bore the blame and was behind these actions, she began plotting the destruction of Masiste's wife. She waited until her husband Xerxes was about to hold the royal banquet, a feast prepared just once each year, on the day the king was born. This banquet is called Tikta in Persian, but in Greek it means complete. On that day alone, the king anoints his own head and bestows gifts upon the Persians. Watching for this day, Amestris begged Xerxes to give her the wife of Masiste. He thought this a terrible and monstrous thing, both to hand over his brother's wife, and because she was innocent of the matter, for he understood the reason she was asking for it. But in the end, since she pressed him persistently and he was constrained by the custom that whoever makes a request cannot be refused when the royal banquet is set out, very much against his will he consented, and having handed her over, he did as follows. He told his wife to do as she wished, while he, summoning his brother, said this. "Masiste, you are the son of Darius and my brother, and besides this you are a good man. The woman you now live with, do not live with her any longer. Instead, in her place, I give you my own daughter. Live with her, and give up the woman you now have, for it does not please me that you keep her." Masiste, astonished at these words, said this. "Master, what useless proposal is this you put to me, bidding me give up a wife by whom I have young sons and daughters, one of whom you yourself took as a wife for your own son, and she herself happens to suit my judgment entirely, that you bid me put her aside and marry your daughter. I, O king, count it a great honor to be deemed worthy of your daughter, yet I will do neither of these things. Do not force me by violence to such a course. Instead, for your daughter another husband will appear no worse than I, and as for me, allow me to keep living with my own wife." So he answered in this manner, and Xerxes, enraged, said this: "This is how matters stand for you, Masists. I will neither give you my daughter to marry, nor shall you live with that woman any longer, so that you may learn to accept what is given to you." On hearing this, Masists, saying only this much, went out: "Master, you have not yet destroyed me." And in the during this interval, while Xerxes was speaking with his brother, Amestris summoned Xerxes' guards and disfigured the wife of Masists. She sliced off her breasts and flung them to the dogs, cut away her nose, ears, lips, and tongue, and sent her home in this mutilated state. Masists, who as yet knew nothing of what had happened, though sensing some misfortune had struck, rushed home at a run. Seeing his wife destroyed, he at once, after consulting with his sons, set out for Bactra with his own sons and, no doubt, some others as well, intending to bring the Bactrian province into revolt and to do the king the greatest harm possible. And this is what would have happened, as I believe, if he had reached the Bactrians and the Sacchi in time, for they loved him and he was governor of the Bactrians. But Xerxes, learning what he was doing, sent an army after him and killed him on the road, along with his sons and his army. So much for the story of Xerxes' passion and the death of Masists. As for the Greeks who had set out from Mycale for the Hellespont, they first anchored off Lectum, held back by winds, and from there came to Abydos, where they found the bridges broken up, which they had expected to find still in place. And it was largely for this reason that they had come to the Hellespont. Now the Peloponnesians under Leotichides decided to sail back to Greece, but the Athenians and their general Xanthippus decided to remain and make an attempt on the Chersonese. So the others sailed away, but the Athenians crossed from Abydos to the Chersonese and laid siege to Sestos. Since this was the strongest fortified place in that region, when they heard that the Greeks had arrived at the Hellespont, people gathered into it from the surrounding towns, and in particular from the city of Cardia, came a Persian named Oabazus, who had brought there the tackle from the bridges. This place was held by native Aeolians, but with them were Persians and a large crowd of other allies as well. The governor of this province under Xerxes was Ardactes, a Persian, a clever and unscrupulous man, who had once deceived the king himself when he was marching against Athens by stealing the treasures of Protesilaus, son of Iphiclus, from Aleus. For at Aleus on the Chersonese stands the tomb and sacred enclosure of Protesilaus, where great wealth was kept, bowls of gold and silver, bronze vessels, garments, and other dedications, all of which Ardactes seized with the king's consent, having tricked Xerxes with words like these: "Master, there stands here the house of a Greek who marched against your land, and having met his rightful end, died for it. Grant me his house, so that people may learn not to campaign against your land." By saying this, he easily persuaded Xerxes to give him the man's house, for the king had no suspicion of what Ardactes had in mind. He said that Protesilaus had campaigned against the king's land, meaning this: "The Persians consider the whole of Asia to belong to themselves and to whoever is king at the time." Once the grant had been made, Ardactes carried off the treasures from Aleus to Sestos, and he sowed and worked the sacred precinct as farmland, and whenever he came to Aleus, he would have sex with women inside the very inner sanctuary. Now he was under siege by the Athenians, having neither prepared for a siege nor expecting the Greeks. They had fallen upon him, somehow inescapably. When autumn came upon the besiegers, the Athenians grew distressed at being away from home and unable to take the wall, and they asked their generals to lead them back home. But the generals refused to do so until they either took the place or were recalled by the Athenian government. So the men resigned themselves to the situation. Meanwhile, those inside the wall had by now come to the very depths of suffering, so much so that they were boiling the leather straps of their beds and eating them. When even this ran out, then under cover of night the Persians and Ardactes and Oabazus fled, climbing down behind the wall at the point where the enemy's line was thinnest. When day came, the people of the Chersonese signaled to the Athenians from the towers what had happened and opened the gates. Of the Athenians, most set off in pursuit, while some occupied the city. Oabazus, as he fled into Thrace, was caught by the Thracian Apsinthians, who sacrificed him to their local god Plestorus in their own manner, and killed his companions in a different way. Those with Ardaix who had set out to flee later were overtaken, still few in number, beyond the river Aegispotami. After resisting for a long time, some were killed and others taken alive. The Greeks bound them and led them to Sestos, and with them Ardaix himself in bonds, along with his son. One of the guards, it is said, was roasting salted fish when a portent occurred among the Chersonesites. The salted fish lying on the fire leapt and writhed as though they were freshly caught. Those standing around were amazed, but Ardaix, when he saw the portent, called to the man roasting the fish and said, "Athenian stranger, do not be afraid of this portent. It was not shown to you, but to me it signals that Protesilaus at Elias, even though dead and reduced to a salted fish, has power from the gods to punish the one who wronged him. Now I am willing to offer this as compensation. In place of the treasures I took from the sanctuary, I will pay the god 100 talents, and in place of myself and my son, I will give the Athenians 200 talents, if I am spared." With these promises he did not persuade the general Xanthippus, for the people of Elias, seeking vengeance for Protesilaus, demanded that he be put to death, and the general's own inclination led the same way. So they led him off to the place where Xerxes had bridged the strait, or, as some say, to the hill above the city of Madidus, and nailing him to planks, they hung him up there, and his son they stoned to death before Ardaix's own eyes. Having done this, they sailed back to Greece, bringing with them the other treasures and also the tackle of the bridges to dedicate in the temples. Nothing further happened that year beyond this. Now the ancestor of this Ardaix who was hanged, Artimbares, was the man who proposed to the Persians the plan which they took up and brought to Cyrus, saying the following: "Since Zeus grants leadership to the Persians, and among men to you, Cyrus, having brought down Astyages, come, since we possess a small and rugged land, let us leave it and take possession of another, better one. There are many such lands bordering us and many farther off. If we take one of these, we shall be admired by more people. It is fitting that a ruling people should do such things, for when will we have a better opportunity than now, when we rule over many peoples and the whole of Asia?" Cyrus, hearing this, was not impressed by the proposal, but told them to go ahead and do it, though he warned them, as he did so, to prepare themselves no longer to be rulers, but to be ruled. "For soft lands," he said, "tend to breed soft men, since it is not the nature of any one land to produce both wonderful crops and men good at war." So the Persians, recognizing this and yielding to Cyrus' judgment, went away and abandoned the plan, choosing rather to rule while living in a harsh land than to be slaves to others while farming a plain.